Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. July was the hottest month ever recorded in the lower 48 states, breaking a record setting during the Dust Bowl of the 1930s. According to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the U.S. keeps setting records for weather extremes based on calculations that include drought, heavy rainfall, unusual temperatures, and storms. A few other headlines we've seen in the past couple of days: ocean acidification disrupting marine food chains, warming releases lethal Arctic methane. Many scientists are trying to figure out why, in the face of so much research and data and headlines on the effects of global warming, the public seems to be doing very little about it. A new paper in Nature Climate Change identifies six reasons why, unlike financial fraud, climate change does not register emotionally as a wrong that demands to be righted. And the number one reason they came up with is that climate change is tough to understand. So on today's Your Call, we've invited a panel of guests to give us their reasons, what messages and tactics actually work, and what messages and tactics do not work. Today, we are joined by Annie Leonard, creator of The Story of Stuff, a 20-minute animated video that analyzes our system of consumption. The video has been watched by at least 750,000 people on YouTube. Annie is also author of the book, The Story of Stuff. She's traveled to 40 countries, visiting hundreds of factories where our stuff is made and sites where our stuff is dumped. And Annie, I'm assuming that number maybe has gone up by now.
Yeah, 20 million people.
20 million. Oh, my goodness. I'm sorry about that.
In every country in the world.
Okay, I think we got that from a website. 20 million people in every country in the world. Thanks for coming in, Annie.
Thanks.
We're also joined by Jonah Sachs, co-founder and creative director of Free Range Studios, which works with companies and organizations to create story-based brands. His work on videos like The Metrix and The Story of Stuff has brought key social issues to the attention of how many viewers, Jonah?
More than 60 million.
Okay, thank you. More than 60 million. And Jonah is author of a new book, Winning the Story Wars: Why Those Who Tell and Live the Best Stories Will Rule the Future. Thanks for coming in, Jonah.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. And we're joined by Dr. Ed Maybach, professor and director of the Center for Climate Change Communication at George Mason University, where he conducts research on ways to expand and enhance public engagement on the issue of climate change. Hi, Dr. Maybach. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Rose.
Great to have you. And I'd like to welcome, I know we have a full house today, Richard Muller, professor in the Department of Physics at UC Berkeley and senior scientist at the Lawrence Berkeley Lab. Once a doubter of climate change, Richard now believes that humans are almost entirely the cause of climate change. He's author of the new book, Energy for Future Presidents: The Science Behind the Headlines. Hi, Richard. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting me.
Great to have you on. So, Richard, why this change of heart? You're making so many headlines this week. You also wrote an op-ed for the New York Times a couple of days ago.
I like to think we're making headlines because we've been perceived over the last few years as a group that is objective and approaching it purely from the science point of view. If you asked me 3 years ago, I would have said I highly doubt whether the evidence is compelling for global warming. Ask me a year ago, I would have said, well, global warming is real, but we don't know the human cause. And then just in the last 3 to 6 months, we were able to do a scientific analysis to redo the data to answer all of the, I thought, legitimate questions of the skeptics and come to the conclusion that essentially all of global warming for the last 250 years is caused by humans.
So what was it? I mean, what really got you to say, I really need to look at this science again?
I think there were legitimate issues raised. There were so many exaggerations. I was disturbed by an inconvenient truth because, by my estimate, 80 to 85% of that movie is exaggerated or wrong. So many things are attributed to climate change. Every change in the weather is climate change. But more importantly, skeptics had raised issues about the way the data had been analyzed. They had pointed out that the UK group used only about 7% of the available temperature stations. How had they picked them? The larger groups in the U.S. had picked 20%. How had they picked them? It looked like they had picked them in a way that might emphasize global warming. There are issues about station quality. There are issues about how they adjusted the data. In my feeling, any scientist looking at the entire field should have been skeptical. Of course, it's a scientist's duty to be properly skeptical.
Right.
And so I could not convince myself that the analysis they did was correct.
You know, that's amazing. We just had everyone's eyebrows went up when you said that 80 to 90% of an inconvenient truth was exaggerated.
Well, there was a court case in the UK, which is worth looking up. You could find the court judgment online, in which they wanted to distribute that movie freely to all schools in the UK. And it was brought to court by a parent. The court brought in scientists from both sides and finally concluded that, yes, they should be allowed to distribute it freely in the UK to schools as long as it was accompanied by a chart with 9 major errors pointed out, one of them being the fact that polar bears were dying from receding ice.
Hmm.
So it was wonderful to excite people about global warming, and it did that. And to some extent, I was glad they were excited, or I am glad they're excited. But the problem is, when you excite people by exaggeration, eventually they learn they were fooled,
huh.
And then they resent it. And I think part of the backlash we're seeing is the fact that they know that the reason they got excited was based on false information.
So I'd like to ask you about the polar bears in a couple of minutes. But first, we've got people on our show who dedicate their lives to this issue. And if you could take off your scientist hat for a minute and put on your sort of citizen hat, what are your thoughts on just the overall message that you hear from environmentalists? Have you seen, for example, Annie Leonard's The Story of Stuff or other videos that talk about climate change and consumption?
No, I'm anxious to see it, though. But my feeling is that too many people in this field don't respect the public. Scientists I know, and I've talked to them, and these are top scientists, they're deeply concerned about global warming, as I am now, too. But in the past, they have said a little bit of exaggeration, if it gets people involved, will really do some good. And I warned back 3 years ago in my columns that it was more than 3 years ago. I've warned that exaggeration does short-term good, but in the end, people don't like to have been fooled.
And can you be specific on these exaggerations?
Well, okay, let me just give a few good examples. Hurricane Katrina, there's no scientific way that can be attributed to global warming. Hurricane Katrina was only a Category 3 storm when it hit the city. It really didn't do much damage. It passed over the city, but it broke a dike. This was a city that it was the first time it was hit by a medium-sized Category 3 storm in decades. Unless you believe global warming is somehow aiming it. Let me give another example. The recent heat wave in the United States. The last 12 months have been the warmest they have been ever, and that turns out to be true. When I saw that, I looked at our data and said, yes, that's right. But it's also true that the Earth has actually cooled a little bit in this last 12 months. We're seeing what used to be called a heat wave. How can you attribute our heat wave to global warming when the globe isn't warming or didn't warm over the last few years? So there's so much every time anything happens that's bad having to do with weather, someone attributes it to global warming. Tornadoes are not going up. Hurricanes are not increasing. There's all this misinformation out there.
That is Richard Muller, professor in the Department of Physics at UC Berkeley, once a doubter of climate change. He now believes that humans are almost entirely the cause of climate change. So, Annie, what are your thoughts on Richard Muller's conversion and also his focus on exaggeration? He believes that too many people in the movement make exaggerations, and it hurts the cause.
Well, first, Professor Muller, I want to say welcome. Welcome over to our side of this. To the when I say our side, I mean the people who do believe that there's a problem and want to take some action on it. I find it really disheartening to hear about the exaggerations. That has not been my experience. I've spent 25 years working in the environmental community and from early on have had the importance of not exaggerating and being truthful beaten into me because one of the greatest assets we have on our side is the truth. And I feel like we cannot be loose with the facts. So I'm very, very disheartened to hear that that has been your perception. And I definitely... It just hasn't been my experience. Myself and my colleagues, we hold ourselves up to the highest bar in terms of maintaining the truth because we just simply can't afford to be loose with it. At the same time that I say the truth is one of our greatest assets, perhaps the greatest asset, that alone will not solve this problem. I feel that a lot of environmental activists and a lot of climate activists have fallen into this trap of believing that the truth will set us free, that if we can simply document the problem, if we have the right charts, the right graphs, the right parts per formulae and the right scientific report that change will come. And while truth is absolutely essential, that alone will not make change. What we need to do is confirm the reality, for which we're very grateful to have such rigorous scientists. Then we need to communicate the reality in an effective way. And then we need to get together to figure out what we can do about it. And that's really where we are now in this conversation, is what are we going to do about this?
Jonah? I agree completely.
Richard, go ahead.
Yeah, I agree completely. And I know the problem, because according to the official number, the IPCC, which I didn't accept 3 years ago, but I do now, the warming of the Earth over the last 50 years, which is what they attribute to humans, I go back further now, but what they attribute to humans has been 0.64 degrees Celsius. That's two-thirds of 1 degree Celsius. How do you get the public excited or worried about that? The reason to worry about it is that 0.64 is approximately what you expect from greenhouse gases. It fits the curve, and now we have verified that, I think, exquisitely. And the problem is in the future. We have not been suffering really significantly from global warming up till now. Most of the climate things are not connected to that. 0.64 degrees is a small amount. How do you get the public to recognize that this is the tip of the iceberg? Forgive the mixed metaphor, that what we're worried about is not what has happened. Kilimanjaro has not melted because of global warming. But you worry, how do you get the public to worry about it when what we see is a scientific number that matches expectations, and we have deep beliefs that the carbon dioxide in the future will shoot way up?
Well, yeah, there's definitely a problem that communicators have, which is to tell a compelling story and get people interested, you need to make it tangible. And as Richard's pointing out, there's been a sort of rush to make it tangible, bring it down to that single human experience, so I can see it and feel it. And along the way, there's this temptation to exaggerate, of course, and where it's happened, obviously it's hurt the cause. But I also think that there's a need to recognize that we don't need to communicate to every single person and get everybody onto our side. What it really takes is a core of passionate people who trust science, where there's a huge scientific consensus around this at this point, and there's a huge swath of the population that is not hostile to science and to experts, who are willing to listen. And now, how do we get those people motivated and moving to create a political movement? Political movements often start with less than 20% of the population believing something, but when they get passionate and active, things start to change. So you look at what's come from the right on taxes or on abortion. These things become national issues and national political issues without having that kind of major tipping point of the population believing, but they're able to elevate it. I think a huge problem that we've had around communication is we've all been fed the message that there's this giant global problem. Many of us believe it. The best thing to do about it is ride our bike or drive a Prius. And then we do that for a little while. And then when we realize in riding our bike, we get on one cross-country flight and we could ride our bike for 3 years. What happened to all that carbon we just saved? It's not a solution on the scale to the problem. So we get committed, we get excited, and then we start trying to make personal changes and then realize we're not really doing anything. It has to happen on a true political level. So we're burning ourselves out with the same old message. Mm. It's time to create a political message to get the world together to actually reduce emissions.
Well, the other thing is, even on this show, I mean, listening to you, Richard Mueller, say things like, talking about polar bears, or that global warming is not causing the melting on Kilimanjaro. I mean, some of our colleagues said, what? I thought that was actually the case. I mean, some of the things you're even saying on this show, people in the couple studios here thought were true. So, Dr. Maybach, do you want to jump in and talk about that? I mean, what is truth when we're talking about global warming?
Such a great question. I'm actually often chastised for using the term belief in conjunction with climate change. You know, is it valid to say that people believe or don't believe when in fact there is underlying evidence or which scientists would construe as underlying truth? But in reality, we all, regardless of what the underlying evidence is, that 99.99% of all citizens of the world will never look at. Dr. Mueller is obviously a scientist. He works in this area, so he is the exception that proves that rule. The rest of us actually have to make up our mind based on what we choose to believe. Which scientists have we listened to? Which weathercasters have we listened to? What kinds of blog, whose blogs do we read? And ultimately, all of that does influence our understanding of the issue, irregardless of any sense of underlying evidence or truth. And let me just say that about two-thirds of American adults are convinced that the climate is changing, global warming is real. About half of them think that it's primarily human activity this time that's driving the change. About two-thirds of them or slightly less think this is a real problem. It's serious. It's something that we should find a way to deal with. Like Jonah was saying, people get the fact that they're driving their bike or buying a Prius is not a solution commensurate with the scale of the problem. So a lot of people out there are convinced. They're convinced more on the basis of belief than the basis of evidence. And they would like to know, they'd like to hear what real solutions are being proposed.
Right, because two-thirds of the population believing something and then a tiny percentage, if any, knowing what to do about it, that's the gap that we need to be closing, not trying to get that last third to believe and support us.
I think part of the problem here is the stuff they believe is wrong. And so if they believe Hurricane Katrina was caused by humans, or that polar bears are dying, that belief is harmful. I've been to Washington several times, given congressional testimony. What I find is the disconnect there is that many of the Republicans who oppose doing anything about climate change are aware of these arguments that Katrina was not due to global warming, that the polar bears are not dying. When people come and they plead with them to save the polar bears and save the future New Orleans, they recognize that as wrong.
I think
that's part of the problem.
I imagine that the Republicans are not opposing this legislation for the most part because they don't believe it as much as there's entrenched interests that are heavily supporting them that don't want to believe it. So, Bill McKibben.
That's not my experience. My experience is that they are far more familiar with the arguments against the exaggerations than are the Democrats.
I think it's more ideological and
yeah, that's not my experience at all.
Okay. Bill McKibben just put out a very interesting article in Uncover of Rolling Stone about how the fossil fuel industry has committed to digging up and burning five times the amount of carbon that the scientists agree the Earth can stand over the next 50 years to keep the climate within 2 degrees temperature rise.
Whatever
interest.
We do in the U.S. doesn't matter because it's what's happening in China. China is going to be responsible for the increase. China, India, the developing world, that's where most of the future carbon dioxide is going to be coming from. So no matter what we are doing here, it doesn't matter unless we address the issue in China. And this is another reason why I think politicians are avoiding the issue, because we can't just go electric cars here and solve the problem. No, we have to do something that the poor countries of China and India can afford to do. Otherwise, you're not really addressing, you're driving a bicycle, as you said. You're driving a bicycle. That doesn't do the job. The future carbon dioxide is not coming from us.
Well, this is true, but on the global stage, China and India won't act until the United States shows some true leadership. So
leadership has to be leadership that they can afford. If we switch to electric automobiles, for example, hey, a switch to electric automobiles in China would be counterproductive because an electric automobile driven ultimately by coal produces more carbon dioxide than does a gasoline automobile. So our leadership has to be thoughtful. It can't just be we feel good because we have reduced it. It has to be leadership that will work in the developing world. That can be afforded. If they can't afford, I like to think that if it's not affordable, if it's not profitable, it's not sustainable in the poor world, which is where most of the carbon dioxide will be coming from.
But we have to set the market so that it becomes profitable. Right now, there's a global market that's so subsidized for fossil fuels. We need to change the playing field so that it becomes, and I'm not talking about completely artificially pushing one solution over another, but creating a fair playing field for alternatives.
Well, I think subsidies have no impact whatsoever on the fact that China is building 1 new gigawatt of coal every week. That's the fuel they have. It's the cheapest fuel. It's 3 times worse than natural gas. If we environmentalists can't convince our other environmentalists that a switch in China from coal to natural gas is essential, that plus energy conservation, those two things are so big compared to anything else, that's really what we have to do. And I'd like to see the U.S. leadership, our congressmen, I'd like to see our president take the lead on this. But it's hard for them to do that when opponents will say, "But what? Hey, it's not us, it's China."
That is Richard Muller, professor in the Department of Physics at UC Berkeley. Once a doubter of climate change, he now believes that humans are almost entirely the cause of climate change. Jonah Sachs is co-founder and creative director of Free Range Studios. They work with companies and organizations to create story-based brands. He's author of the new book, Winning the Story Wars. Annie Leonard is the creator of The Story of Stuff, a 20-minute animated video that analyzes our system of consumption. And Dr. Ed Maybach is professor and director of the Center for Climate Change Communication at George Mason University. And we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on the overall message from the environmental movement? What do you think is effective? What's not so effective? What kinds of messages get you inspired or maybe motivate family or friends who really don't know much about this but might care about it? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And if you work in the effective messaging world, what are your thoughts about the messages that you hear on a regular basis from the environmental movement? You can also post a comment to yourcallradio.org or email feedback at yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Jerry in Cupertino. Hi, Jerry. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, great. I'll just make a couple of statements. I've been following climate change, global warming, however you want to phrase it, for many years. I believe in it, so I'm going to I'll put that on the table first. But I think pretty much we're toast. I hate to be negative, but I don't see any particular way out of this. As mentioned, it's a global problem. China and India are certainly ramping up their economies, which are going to drive more utilization of coal and oil, which is going to continue to increase the climate change issue. Most of the decisions right now in the United States are economy-based, and we're finding that in fact things aren't being done because they might affect the economy. We can't very well raise the cost of fuel because that will affect the economy, so we'll have to keep that low. We can't put taxes on things because that might affect the economy, so we can't. You know, it's an economic driver. Currently, the fact that I was listening to, I believe, an executive from British Petroleum on a show the other day, and it turns out that, well, gosh, there's a lot of anticipation of, for example, the melting Arctic ice sheet, because they'll be able to collect, you know, mineral deposits, and they'll be able to drill for oil in places they haven't before because of the melting ice.
Well, thank you for calling in. Wasn't Shell just given a green light to start drilling? I'll look that up during the break. But Annie, I wanted you to address this issue, because he just said we're toast. And before the show, we talked a little bit about the sort of doom and gloom messages that we hear on a regular basis.
Right. You know, the truth is the data is not looking good. The trajectory is not looking good. I'm sure some people accuse me of exaggerating in the story of stuff. And the one piece of information that I probably did exaggerate is my sense of optimism. And I do that because I refuse to give up. I think that even though it's not looking good, it's bad form to give up. And I'm going to continue to be hopeful, partly because I think that's our best chance, but also because it's my last act of resistance. I will not do anything other than get out of bed every single morning full of optimism and hope that we can turn things around. The good news is that the kind of ways that we can turn things around are good for the environment, good for the climate, are good for the economy, and are good for our social fabric. So even though we just might be toast, I'm going to get up every single day and do my best, and I invite every single other person to help me.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll get Dr. Maybach to also respond to that question about the doom and gloom versus the more optimistic messages, and we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What do you think of the environmental movement's message? What needs to change and what's working? You can also post a comment to yourcallradio.org. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW. To take part in today's conversation, call 866-798 Talk. That's 866-798-8255. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear new voices. And if you'd prefer to write rather than call, you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a message at yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Tomorrow, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. We'll have a conversation about media coverage of the Sikh temple shooting in Wisconsin and the rise of white supremacists in the U.S. military. We'll also talk about an investigation revealing horrifying details about a U.S.-funded military hospital in Afghanistan. And then speaking of the climate and climate change and oil, we'll be talking about Chevron on Monday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the messaging behind climate change. What do you think of the environmental movement and their overall message? What do you think works? What needs to change? How have you personally been affected by it? If you've got friends or family who might not know how they feel about climate change, how are they affected by the messaging that we get on a regular basis? There are movies, there are videos. You've got politicians who say things like God will take care of it. You've got politicians who don't talk about it at all. I mean, President Obama really doesn't talk about climate change, and we'll talk about that today. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. Today, we're joined by Richard Muller, professor in the Department of Physics at UC Berkeley. He's author of the new book, Energy for Future Presidents. Once a doubter of climate change, he now believes that humans are almost entirely the cause of climate change. Annie Leonard is the creator of the very popular video, The Story of Stuff. Her latest video is The Story of Change, which urges viewers to put down their credit cards and start exercising their muscles to build a more sustainable and fulfilling world. Jonah Sachs is co-founder and creative director of Free Range Studios. They work with companies and organizations to create story-based brands. You may have seen The Matrix. He also worked on The Story of Stuff, and he's author of the new book, Winning the Story Wars. And Dr. Ed Maybach is professor and director of the Center for Climate Change Communication at George Mason University. Dr. Maybach, what are your thoughts on deciding where to focus, on the doom and gloom or the potential hope?
Well, we have a really clear answer to that question because a number of researchers, including my own team, we've looked at it. And the bottom line is that fear is not the answer. There is a lot of doom and gloom inherent in the issue of climate change. Lots of people who work on the issue feel pretty gloomy and espouse a fair amount of doom. The problem with that is that if the message is based in doom and gloom, it tends to turn people away. But the research on fear appeals over the last 50 years has looked at a whole variety of health issues and other sorts of threats to the public. Climate change, social scientists working on climate change have only looked at it more recently, but every time they do look at it, they come to the same conclusion that it's much better to be hopeful than to convey a sense of fear. And it comes back to, I believe, what Jonah was saying earlier before the break, which is that lots of Americans do care about this issue. Very few of them are doing anything about it that is really commensurate with the kind of action that we need to, or actions that we need to bring about. So, for example, while a lot of people are changing the way they shop, relatively few people are picking up the telephone and calling their elected representatives in Washington. Mm. One line of research that we've been conducting recently is looking for different ways of talking about the issue that will be perceived as more hopeful than other ways. So we've looked at framing the issue of climate change as an environmental threat, as a national security threat, and as a health threat. And what we found is that when we talk about climate change as a health issue, including both the threatening aspects of it, the ways in which it can harm human health, but also the beneficial aspects, the ways in which taking action to address climate change can benefit human health, we find that people find that to be fundamentally more hopeful, makes them much more likely to pay attention to the information we've prepared for them, to seek additional information, to share that information with other people that they know. And ultimately, we still haven't tested this, but ultimately we think it's going to make them more likely to take personal actions that will be helpful.
Yeah, I think that sounds right on to me. And I know some people might cringe when you talk about, well, the facts are bleak, but let's be optimistic. But it's really, because that might smack of lying, but it's really where you come together between optimism and truth is where the communicator gets a huge challenge. So we're looking at all this terrible data. This is dangerous. This is bad. How are we truthful to our audiences but still show the positive side where people can actually act and be motivated? That's where we have to kind of come up with theories of change and actually credible actions that people can take to organize, to really make change. And that's why we need to think as organizers and communicators about what people can do. I also, in researching my book, I definitely figured out that human beings have always faced uncertain times. We always want this feeling that the way it is will continue into the future, and we face an uncertain future of risk and danger, and right now more so than ever. And what we've always used is sort of these myths, these great stories that motivate us to believe that we have some kind of control over our future, that we can actually take the reins. And those are hopeful stories that carefully describe the broken world and say, I see the world is broken this way too. You're not sugarcoating it, but then show how great change is possible. And I think that great change is possible right now because of the communication tools that we have right now to create these new stories and new myths that give us a sense of purpose in solving this greatest challenge of all time. Stories used to take millennia to traverse the globe. Now they can do it in seconds. So even as our problems are getting bigger and bigger every moment, the possible solutions for organizing those two-thirds of people in America and more across the whole globe in a new sense of purpose in addressing this are out there. We just need a lot more experimentation, a lot more research to give people a sense of purpose in addressing it.
Brief comment from Rich.
Sure.
I think the doom and gloom has done enormous harm. You may remember 3 years ago in 2009 at the Copenhagen conference to reach an agreement, people said, unless we do it in this year, it is hopeless. We might as well give up. Well, that was 3 years ago. So is it hopeless? No, it's not. The fact is climate change, temperature change has been very small. Climate change is not climate change. Climate change is mostly weather. And there are things we can really do. And I don't want to say I'm optimistic, because here's a list of things we can do. Increased energy efficiency, primarily in China. They can afford it. It's profitable. Help them make a switch from coal to natural gas. If this became a U.S. program to expedite their shift from coal to natural gas, that is so much more important than the fact that I happen to own a Prius.
Well, thank you for the call. And we've got a number of callers. And I also just want to read a comment from Dave in Alameda, who says, your panelists are spot on. The truth is not enough. For the past 20 years, it's been gospel in the GOP that cutting taxes increases revenue for the government. There is no legitimate research to support that, none. Most rational people find it to be a fairy tale. Even the man whose research established the truism in the first place, Arthur Laffer, has said that his research has been abused. This fight is all about messaging. And we have another comment from Cindy in Sacramento. She says, I write this in all seriousness. If you want to know what works, watch Fox and watch climate denialist camps. Despite reams of science and data, fewer Americans believe climate change is real now than in the past decade. Why? Let's pull our heads out of the sand. It's the incredibly effective messaging being pumped through by right-wing media.
And that's all values-based messaging. And stories that work are always appealing directly to people's values. And what Fox does is spend very little time on the facts and a lot more time on the values, appealing to people's sense of their own family, what's important to them, their own sort of prejudged notions of how the world is. We can do the same thing, appeal to values in the exact same way with facts behind us. But we do get obsessed. It's easy to get obsessed when you have a mountain of facts behind you. When you don't have the facts behind you, you focus on the values because you don't have the facts to work with. When you have the facts, you forget to talk about values. And values have always been what's most important to human beings, because we can't judge. We can't judge all the facts. We can only respond to what we value. So let's stop trying to educate everybody about all the facts and really figure out what values we can motivate to get people to do something.
I think we have to stop blaming Fox for our failure. I think when I watch MSNBC from the point of view of a scientist, it's equally bad on the opposite side. They're blaming everything on global warming, things that just aren't scientifically approached. So both sides are the greatest doubter, the greatest denier of all is Al Gore, because he went far beyond what the UN committee said. Most of what's in the Inconvenient Truth is not supported by the IPCC report. they've gone way beyond that, and in that exaggeration have led people away from the science. So we have to be careful. I blame us as much as I blame anybody.
Do you want to jump in, Annie?
Well, I was going to say the facts are tricky because if you do understand them, if you really are a scientist, they're very compelling. But for the average person, they can be boring. They can be confusing. They can be overwhelming. One environmental advocate told me that they felt like the conversations around about climate change were so fact and jargon laden that they were like a speeding train and there was no way for somebody not already on it to join the conversation. Another problem with focusing on the facts, besides excluding people from the conversation, which is pretty big, is there is a big probability of making mistakes. I'll agree with the other panelists on that. There's a confusion about weather and climate change, which are different things. Non-scientists tend to overly weight most recent weather events, so we get confused about big pictures. The other thing is that there scientifically is a real problem with linking specific events to big picture trends. Just like a lifelong smoker who gets lung cancer cannot absolutely prove that his or her cancer was from smoking, it is impossible scientifically to absolutely prove a specific event was related to this big picture thing. But still, with smoking, even if the individual smoker cannot prove that his or her cancer is from smoking, we know that smoking is harmful. The same thing with this. We know that pumping huge amounts of carbon into the climate is harmful. Even if we can't make a connection between a specific polar bear on a specific piece of shrinking ice, even if we can't do that. So let's put that science aside for a moment, since we know that there's a problem, and get out of that debate and work together instead for bigger picture solutions that we can do to begin to transition to a clean energy economy. We've got to do it for so many reasons: climate, environment, health, economy. For all these reasons, let's just think about some of the solutions and start putting them in place.
Well, we've got a number of callers on the line, so I just want to go through a few because they've been waiting patiently. So, and some of these are all about fact also. Let's hear from Andy in Redwood City. Hi, Andy.
Hi, how you doing, Rose?
Good, thank you.
I'm kind of upset that you put Professor Mueller on this show. This guy is something else, man. Number one, 85 to 90% of Al Gore's film, Inconvenient Truth, is not a lie. You're a liar, sir. Polar bears are dying.
Andy,
NRDC
we've got Richard on the line. If we can be respectful, why don't you have a dialogue with Richard? Andy, are you still there?
He's a corporate...
Andy, are you still there? If we can just speak respectfully, just have a dialogue with Richard.
Respect.
No, I don't lie. That's
you're
one thing
liar.
I learned
you're
in my youth. I do not lie.
You are a disgrace to Berkeley. You are a disgrace to humanity, sir. You are a...
this is a field in which many people get attention by being rude. Our Berkeley Earth Project, what we have tried to do is to take that aspect of this, which is purely science, and we have really worked hard to get a reputation as being both transparent, all of our data is online, everything's online, of being follow the facts and achieve the best. I think science is that narrow realm of knowledge in which, in principle, there can be universal agreement. So let's agree on the science, and then when we get to what we can do about it, we have to recognize that the carbon dioxide of the future is coming from China. And this is not a disputed fact. It's just one that people don't talk about. If we don't address that, buying a Prius doesn't do any good.
And, Richard, we're also receiving a few emails about your funders. You receive $150,000 from the Koch Foundation.
Right. They supported us to do the best science. People don't appreciate the way to win over the Republicans is to recognize that the issues they raised had substance, and you address those. The Koch brothers knew that there were serious issues with the science that was done. They gave us funding to straighten it out. I talked to one of the Koch brothers recently, and he was pleased that we had actually achieved this. So we also got money from people from the full political spectrum. These are all people who believe, like I do, that the answer to the contention, let's agree on the science and then determine what kind of politics we want to use to solve the problem.
Well, and this is important because the Koch brothers gets a lot of attention for many, many reasons. What are your thoughts, any of you, about kind of writing off an organization because they get funding from the Koch brothers?
One-sixth of our funding.
Annie, Jonah, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's unfair to, you know, write off the credibility of someone because of what their funding source is. It certainly makes sense to raise it and bring it up. But I do think what we've seen with the Koch brothers and their success in raising marginal issues to the center of the political battleground, that needs to be emulated in a lot of ways as well. We need a lot of people to understand that this is a political fight. This is actually a battle. There are people who, with entrenched interests, I disagree with Robert that this is sort of just an existential problem that only goes to the level of China. I think there's a lot of interest and a lot of money in going along as business as usual. This is a political battle, and just as the Koch brothers have declared war on the left in a lot of ways, I think we need large funders and the movement to push them up and get them into the battle to really name the interests that are pushing business as usual and to go after them and make this a political fight. Democracy in the United States actually is a huge lever to change this, to address this problem, regardless of what's happening in China. And I think that we need the people who have that sense of purpose, like the Koch brothers have, to save the planet, though, on the other side, to actually get involved in this fight.
Well, all right. Well, we have a number of callers. Let's go through a few, and then we'll get you all to respond. Let's hear from Francis in San Francisco. Hi, Francis.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay, great. Thank you. I'm a member of 350.org, and I've been working for many years to change the perception of climate change in the country. And I think that the way that would be most helpful to go at this point is to do what Bill McKibben's recent article in Rolling Stone suggested, which is begin to understand that climate change is a moral issue, and that we have children, many of us, and those of us who don't probably care about at least a few children. And the issue is, what kind of world do we leave them? I have a grandson now, and I'm thinking about what's it going to be like when he's 25 and 30 years old. I think this is a moral country. I think we can think about this issue much more easily and much in a less partisan way when we just start to realize that our kids and our grandchildren's quality of life is on the line concerning this issue, and then act accordingly.
I think that's a great point. And I think one of the things that we've seen has been a bit of backsliding, in my opinion, in the strategy about climate change. We fell into a bit of a hole recently of having to make it an economic benefit issue. It's a green jobs issue. And we move away from that moral issue to make it more transactional, to fit in with the kind of conversation of the day. But I think it really is a moral issue. We haven't found that right note to hit to make that moral argument perfect and really craft it. But the more that we talk about, well, it's simply for your own benefit or day-to-day benefit, is really a problem. We need to figure out how to really get that moral issue out there.
Well, I also think it's a moral issue. I've been recently in China, and they regard it as a moral issue. But it's a complex moral issue because they believe they have a moral right to give good health, good jobs, a good economy to their people. And they have to balance that. So they're building a new gigawatt of coal every week. If the U.S. were to cut back 10% or 100%, if we cut back 100% within 4 years, the emissions would be back where they were because of the Chinese growth. So the moral issue can't ignore the poverty of China and India. And yet that's where the carbon dioxide is coming from. So we have to address that. We keep just doing feel-good measures. I own a Prius. You know, that does no good whatsoever. We have to address the moral issue, which is not just the global warming, but also the problems that are so large in China, India, and the poor world.
Dr. Maybach, do you want to jump in there?
Morality is a tough one because one person's moral judgment may fly directly in the face of another person's moral judgment, as Richard was just suggesting. It's very context dependent, and when climate change advocates attempt to make moral arguments, they are certainly as likely to piss off as many people as they are likely to win over. Part of the problem in this country, I believe, and our research would suggest, is in terms of moving forward with policy solutions to the problem, is that for all the success that climate advocates have had in trying to engage the public to support political action, they have engendered an equal and opposite, if not greater, reaction on the other side. Something I wanted to mention closer to the top of the hour is that if you wind back the clock all the way back to 1997 or so, around the time when Al Gore was in Kyoto negotiating the Kyoto Protocol on behalf of the United States, two out of three Americans believe that the global warming was real and a potentially serious problem. And if you recall, I said earlier in the hour that two out of three Americans still believe it's real and a serious problem. But that the fact that the average hasn't changed masks a really important development in American society, and that is liberals are almost all convinced that it's real and a serious problem by this point, whereas conservatives have changed their views in large numbers. That's only about a third of conservatives believe this is a real and serious problem. So moral judgments articulated by one side of the issue have a way of backfiring with people who have reached a different conclusion.
Well, and we have an email from Marcia who says, your first caller nailed it. It's all about money and politics. And Annie, what about the fact that President Obama rarely talks about this issue?
Well, that is frustrating. And on one level, I blame him and wish that he would talk about it more. But on another level, I blame all of us because we need to make it an issue. We all know it's a problem. There's a difference between a problem and an issue. And the way that we make a problem an issue is by getting involved, by flexing our citizen muscles, by turning up the volume on the conversation. So it's fine if people want to buy a Prius, change their light bulb, all that kind of stuff. But what we really need to do is get involved in as active citizens in our democracy. We have two problems in our democracy right now. One is that the corporations have undue influence. They have too much involved in our democracy. And the other is that the people have disengaged, have checked out. So what I'd like to say is everybody, please get involved as a citizen. Call your elected representative. Write letters to the editor for newspapers. Bring this issue up in your church, in your neighborhoods, in your PTA. This has got to be, we have got to work together to turn this problem into a real issue and force Obama and every other elected official to talk about it.
Well, but what about the fact that people have protested on, for example, Keystone? People are saying do not allow Shell to go to the Arctic. And look what's happening.
You know, it's not over till it's over. Those were great protests on Keystone. Those are the first massive public protests we've seen on climate change in this country, though, for a long, long time. Compare that to the level of protest that we saw in the civil rights movement and so many other major social transformations. We need to get out there in the streets. We need to get on the phones. We need to get our computers working on all levels. We need to be engaged to turn this volume up on this conversation.
Yeah, this is Rich. I think the reason President Obama, is not raising the issue publicly is because privately he has no good answer to the rejoinder that his policy is U.S. only, that China is now, by the end of this year, emitting twice the greenhouse gases of the U.S., and in another 15 years it'll be more per person than the U.S., and any policy that doesn't address that, he doesn't have a good answer.
Well, we've got a few emails on this. Amy in Alameda says, your previous caller was so right. We should be framing this in terms of the moral issue. Just as it's immoral to leave our kids trillions of dollars of debt, it's equally immoral to leave our kids a massive climate debt. Bill in Palo Alto says, until we achieve structural change in Washington, we can message until we're all blue in the face, it won't matter. A minority of red state senators can now block everything. It's not democratic, but it's reality. So it strikes me that the emphasis should be on structural change. If we don't get that, we'll need to convince 75% of Americans, and that simply will not happen. Well, thanks for those emails. Let's take a few more calls, and then we'll get responses. Let's hear from Kevin in San Francisco. Hi, Kevin.
Hi. There's a resource I would like to direct people to. As was mentioned, we live in a capitalist society, and if we don't change the business model that's operating in the world, we're doomed. So if you go to sfenvironment.org, it's the San Francisco Department of the Environment where I work, sfenvironment.org. In the top right corner, there's a picture of our director, Melanie Nutter. You click on it, and you get a 16-page document called Making Sustainability Profitable. And it's all the ways that the San Francisco Department of the Environment helps companies improve their profits by wasting less resources, and that includes energy, garbage, water, heating and air conditioning, et cetera, et cetera. We do that free to companies and to residences and help them save money by saving the environment, getting the green of money and the green of nature to coincide.
And this is Kevin Danaher with Global Exchange. I didn't know you were working with the San Francisco Department of the Environment now.
Yes, ma'am. We just set up a new nonprofit arm called Friends of SF Environment that will do some of the more entrepreneurial stuff. We're starting a Green Guardians program at Mission High School, some other projects. And I want to remind people that KALW comes live to the San Francisco Green Festival November 10th and 11th at 8th and Brannan at the San Francisco Concourse.
Yep, we're looking forward to it, Kevin, but we hope it doesn't come soon because things are moving too quickly. But thank you so much for calling in. Let's hear from a couple more callers, Lisa and Carmel. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. I appreciate all your guests and their, you know, opinions and new information coming in about this problem. It seems to me that I've been so concerned about this problem, although I admit I haven't known what to do about it, for 30 years or more. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I first heard the inkling that we might be causing this, I thought, oh, my God, you know, we really, and that there would be a point of no return. That alarmed me. Now, I heard on a program, I think it was maybe on July 6th that you had on your call, what is the right tone to use when talking about climate change? I thought, my God, the right tone is drama, because it seems to me that even if we go to economics as a way to get people involved in this, we could point out that this will be a total disaster economically for our future and our children's future. And I think that scientific people, I'm so glad, you know, that scientific people are coming around, but for a long time they're so concerned about having absolute proof that there's a correlation, when they could probably have stretched their imagination and been able to speak out saying, you know, I'm not absolutely sure we are causing it, but there's a good chance we may be, and if we are, there may be a point of no return.
Well, Lisa, thank you so much for calling in, and we've got about a minute and a half left, enough time for final thoughts from everyone. So Dr. Ed Maybach, professor and director of the Center for Climate Change at George Mason, what are your final thoughts on this issue? 30 seconds.
Yeah, we talked earlier about facts that matter and facts that don't, true but useless information. There is actually a misperception, a myth out there that's held by 2 out of 3 adults that really matters a lot, and that is most Americans believe the experts on global warming are still, there's a lot of disagreement among the experts. In reality, there's overwhelming agreement among the experts that climate change is real, it's human-caused, and it's a serious problem that deserves to be reckoned with somehow. And finding a way to get that out will actually be a wonderful, hopeful, optimistic message, because it will turn the conversation, the dialogue in this country, from a it's happening, it's not happening debate to a what should we do about it kind of dialogue.
Thank you. And Annie Leonard, final thoughts?
I just want to encourage everybody to get involved. Not only is that the best strategy for making actual change, but it helps to alleviate some of that tension and angst we feel between the gap between our actions and our understanding of the world. So everybody, please get involved. There are so many wonderful organizations working on this. Find one of them, call them up, join in.
Thank you. Jonah?
Yeah, I think just want to, I hope people who are concerned about this issue will move from a sense of I am the problem to the larger sense of we are the problem, and really start working together and in joint action, and then realize that the problem even goes higher to some of those, that this is actually is a battle, and this is a war between some entrenched interests and those of us who want to try to save the world. Stop worrying so much about those who are on the side of the entrenched interests, and let's go at it.
And Richard, 15 seconds.
Look at the numbers. Emotions, feelings, morality, that's important, but look at the numbers and recognize that the two things that could work would be improved energy efficiency in China and a switch from coal to natural gas in China.
All right.
Those totally swamp anything else we propose.
Thank you. Richard Mueller, Annie Leonard, Jonah Sachs, and Dr. Ed Maybach, thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
And thanks for your phone calls and emails. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll have a conversation about coverage of the Sikh temple shooting in Wisconsin and the rise of white supremacists in the U.S. military. We'll also talk about the investigation revealing horrifying details about a U.S.-funded military hospital in Afghanistan. We'll be joined by freelance journalist Tanvir Ali, investigative journalist Matt Kennard, and the Wall Street Journal's Maria Abi-Habib joins us from Kabul. Where did you see the best reporting this week? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. We'll be right back.